From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, Hyperloop. Can a network of tubes become the high-speed transportation solution for Texas? This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. A drive from Dallas to Laredo is 430 miles, and if I-35 doesn't get those traffic congestion hang-ups, it can be done in under 7 hours. But in a Hyperloop, that trip would take well under an hour. San Antonio to Austin, that would be about 10 minutes. Hyperloop is experimental. It's a developing technology that uses high-speed pods in near-vacuum tubes to travel at super high speeds. This week, the Dallas-Fort Worth Regional Transportation Council announced plans to begin studying Hyperloop for the DFW area. Stephen Duong is the Hyperloop Texas project leader for AECOM, a Fortune 500 engineering and construction firm.
I think this is a major step in the right direction. This is something that we've been looking forward to, honestly, ever since the day that we submitted and won the Hyperloop One Global Challenge. The first step that you see across the U.S., and in particular what we're looking for in Texas, is to begin these feasibility studies and then transition into what we call environmental impact studies, which is what part of the announcement that the Regional Transportation Council just made. So a lot of the news coverage is regarding the advancement of both these feasibility and environmental studies, and these are the first policy sets that need to happen before further consideration of Hyperloop alignments and where they actually go and how they're going to be delivered are considered.
So the Hyperloop One Global Challenge, it was hundreds of submissions. Three in the United States were granted the green light to go forward. Yours is one of them, a master plan that would look at connecting Dallas, Laredo, and Houston into this triangle with San Antonio being in a bullseye. Tell us more about that.
Sure. So actually, there were over 2,600 submittals from across the globe. And you're correct. They chose 10 finalists as essentially the greenlit preferred Hyperloop study areas across the world, and there were three in the U.S. We're very fortunate that Texas was selected as one of them, and the concept that we like to call it, which is a fairly well-known term in the transportation industry, but we call it the Texas Triangle. And that means, yes, we're looking to connect Dallas-Fort Worth, Austin, San Antonio, Houston, and Laredo, many of the major primary cities of Texas. The reason we want to do so, and especially why Laredo is there, is that we want to see if we can connect these cities and allow them to operate greater than the sum of their parts. The idea is that if you can move between these cities very quickly, you can have a lot of synergy between the strongest assets of these various cities, including their airports, their seaports, their businesses, their actual natural and cultural assets, and allows the state of Texas to operate almost as one city or a mega region as opposed to several disparate entities.
But when you mention Laredo, I think of freight right away, and people talk
Absolutely.
About Hyperloop as a way to move people around, but I guess it's also a way to move product around.
Absolutely. One of the main benefits of using something like a Hyperloop is that it is meant to treat both freight and passengers equally. So think of it more as a mobility system that is content neutral. It doesn't necessarily care whether you're moving people or cargo. It just moves things at very high speed across long distances. And so you're right. The main reason for Laredo is because it's one of the biggest inland ports in the U.S., especially for goods coming from Latin America and Mexico. And when you pair that up with the Port Authority of Houston, in Houston you have one of the busiest and most significant seaports on the east coast of the United States, along with the major airports that reside in our major metros, and you have a connection between land, sea, and air across the entire state of Texas. And when you can move goods or people across all those different assets in the state, within 20, 30 minutes. You can almost treat the Hyperloop almost as an extended runway connecting all those assets and allows Texas to operate as a large logistics hub that can service all types of modes as opposed to having these facilities kind of scattered across the state and necessarily being connected by, traditional freight movement.
We see the videos, the little animations of the Hyperloop, and we usually just see one capsule shooting down through the tube like a bullet through a gun. But do you think that in reality, if and when this thing is created, that it's actually going to be more like a train with lots of these going down the line all together?
Possibly. One of the great things about the technology is that the pod designs and the way they're configured is very customizable. So you're right. Most of the renderings and the videos you see now show kind of a one pod concept that moves through. We do think that's going to be the primary way the system works, mostly because the idea is that there are no intermediate stops in the Hyperloop. The idea is that it's always moving from point to point, from origin to destination without interruption. In order to do so, all those different products are meant to arrive straight to their destination. So, you know, if you're loading up a pod full of cargo or passengers and you want to go to, let's say, San Antonio, you don't have to stop in Austin. So as those pods are unlinked, they can, you know, then separate when appropriate, going along the same corridor and kind of diverge their paths to head to their appropriate destination. However, in certain cases, if there's a large cargo shipment or something like that, you could see a scenario where they are linked together, but it's a little bit too early to confirm whether that's going to be an effective plan or not down the road. For now, most of the concepts are focused on kind of that singular pod concept, mostly because of the way people intend or expect people and passengers and cargo to be delivered in the future.
But this is mass transportation. We're talking about moving millions of people in an annual basis. Just at the San Antonio International Airport alone, 9 million passengers flew there last year. If you're trying to, and then we talk about how many people were driving up I-35 at any given time. I mean, we're talking about a lot of people.
Absolutely. Yes, and so it's one of the things that helps with the volume of Hyperloop is that it has extremely fast headwave. And by headway, I mean the time in between in which each pod arrives at a theoretical station. So as opposed to a lot of public transit or commuter rail in the U.S., where you have headways that are very long, sometimes an hour, sometimes several hours, sometimes 30 minutes, the headways that we're looking in Hyperloop are much closer to about 30 seconds or so. And the idea is that the system is meant to be on demand. You don't necessarily need to schedule when you want to do your trip or hop onto the pod. Whenever you need to go, you can just get on because there are so many frequent pods arriving at the station, going to different destinations. And so it is meant to be an on-demand service. So it's a different delivery model, which means that the linking of the tubes may not necessarily or may not be as necessary as in previous technologies. But you're right. So it is intended to move a high volume passenger, just like commuter, light rail, and airports, but just in a different way. And one of the ways it can increase that volume by having smaller pods is having much higher frequencies and shorter headways on when those pods arrive.
We're talking about a vacuum in a giant tube. Creating a vacuum in a tube like that is not as easy as it might sound.
Right. So it's a near vacuum as opposed to a full vacuum, just because that last extra effort to go from a near vacuum to a full vacuum is extraordinarily difficult, and then maintaining it is. But the near vacuum gets you most of the benefits that they're looking for anyways. And the idea behind the near vacuum, right, is to reduce the amount of air drag on the pod as it slips through. So as these pods are floating on magnets, you know, levitating just above their track a couple inches, it can slip through the tube with very little resistance, which lowers the energy consumption, makes the system more durable and resistant to wear and tear over time, reducing maintenance costs. And so the concept that Hyperloop One is currently working with is to have kind of these pump stations, if you will, installed every set distance or so along the tube that allows it to maintain that low pressure environment. But they've already been doing tests where they can see that, you know, if there are small leakages or punctures here and there and it loses some of the near vacuum, I guess, ideal environment, the system still performs relatively well. So it's not as if the system will completely fall apart if there was air. It just reduces the efficiency on the motors and, you know, how fast the system can go because it runs into the air resistance inside the tube.
The test track that they have in Nevada is 500 meters long. And that
Correct.
Still presents a lot of different challenges looking at the physics of trying to evacuate the air that you want and to create the near vacuum than it would be if it's going to be, say, 200 miles long.
Yes. And so the 500-meter track they have is extremely important because it allows them to run scenarios and polish technology. So that system in Nevada is a near vacuum. And you've probably, I'm sure, seen the news. They've been running their pods publicly at right around 300 miles an hour or so, I believe, in that near vacuum environment just on the 500 meters. So they're really using that to understand and polish the different parts of the technology more before they start deploying it at longer distances. But in the system they have now, they have kind of done a very good job of maintaining the near vacuum and operating the system with the series of pumps and, you know, the motors and the electrical systems and the software and the like. And so that them having been the first and only Hyperloop company in the entire world to have actually built and tested a full-scale track is extremely significant and can't be understated, because it's the only way for them to really refine this in a real-world setting.
And I think it's important for people to realize that just because it's only reached speeds of just under 300 miles an hour, which is, you know, very fast, it's not because of the limits of the technology. It's because of the limits of the how short this run is. 500 meters
exactly
doesn't give you enough time to reach maximum speed.
That's exactly right. Yep. And they are very confident they can achieve much higher speeds. But, and you're absolutely right. So the speeds that they're already reaching are already very comparable, if not a little bit faster than many bullet train systems across the entire world. And they do think they can get even more performance out of it. But you're absolutely right. It's that 300 miles an hour set was more of a function of the length of the track rather than a limit on the actual propulsion technology they're using.
But they haven't had a human passenger yet.
That's correct. They have not.
And
I don't believe that will happen. Well, they're still working on refining a lot of the health, safety, and welfare systems on redundancy. Where they're at right now is they're really publicly trying to polish the actual technology. So that includes the propulsion system, the brake system, making sure that it works under certain circumstances. And I don't think they'd be comfortable testing a human, obviously, until they're very sophisticated and mature on some of the evacuation safety systems. And so you'll see some of the press right now, what they're trying to deal with is because it's in a low pressure environment, should something happen to the pod, they need to figure a way to deliver more oxygen inside the pod for passengers to stay conscious. And, you know, they were first testing a similar system to what airlines do, which is drop down oxygen mask. But they're realizing that the oxygen mask doesn't quite get them there because of the low pressure environment. And there's a less oxygen for them to work with. So those are some of the systems they're now able to negotiate because they have this test track that they would want to have, obviously, more, you know, perfected before they start testing this on passengers. So I know the system is meant to move both passengers and cargo, and there's a lot of excitement about passengers moving along the system very quickly. But I think there are reasons to maybe make an assumption that you'll see freight movement inside the system possibly earlier on than passengers, since those freight systems don't necessarily require the same, you know, light, air, evacuation systems that a passenger system might.
How does that impact the economics of moving freight? Is it really that important that a truck of car parts move at minutes rather than a day across Texas?
Oh, absolutely. There's a term in the freight industry called just-in-time delivery, and it describes a phenomenon in which the expectations for people on cargo delivery and general freight logistics has rapidly changed. So the easiest, most obvious example people like to point to is the way that Amazon has changed the expectations around goods delivery to on a consumer side, right? So Amazon has their Prime Now service, which allows in many major metro areas across the state, including many in here in Texas, to have free two-hour delivery of their goods. So people can order groceries at 4 o'clock and it's delivered right to their door by 6 o'clock. And a lot of those trends are changing how long people expect to wait for their delivery. So Hyperloop is meant to help address some of those changing expectations. The other side is that if you have just-in-time delivery on a larger scale of logistics, inventory management for various companies becomes a lot more efficient, because instead of having to, let's say, pre-stock your warehouse a week ahead of time, making assumptions on how much cargo you think you'll move that week, you can actually just order more parts or cargo as inventory requires throughout the week. So that allows you to be much more efficient without having to necessarily try and predict and forecast what you may need for that rest of the week, which could lead to loss.
So this would just be a way to sort of lube product quicker, create less drag on sales?
Yes, but I actually, so that's one part of it. The other side of it is that I think the idea of being able to move both people and goods across such long distances so quickly actually will likely induce an entirely new market that didn't exist before. So some of that could be many of us may want to, let's say, drive from San Antonio to Dallas, but we don't necessarily do it as often because we know there's a long drive or you have to purchase an airline ticket. So what does the true market look like if you could actually do that trip for an affordable price in under 30 minutes? That may induce a market that just doesn't currently exist, and the same could be applied to cargo. So while there are efficiencies to be gained In the existing, I would say, market demand and the existing framework of which people move people and goods around the state, we would expect that to dramatically increase because of the new options available through something like a Hyperloop. So the idea is that the Hyperloop could then capture a lot of that new market, and it's not necessarily that it's changing or removing market share from, let's say, traditional freight cargo rail lines or even airports. It's inducing an entirely new market that didn't exist before. So it's increasing the pool of, markets and people to begin with.
But I-35, as it exists right now, is almost not functioning. There's so much traffic on the interstate
right.
that you can't even guarantee if I'm going to drive right now to Dallas that I'm actually going to get there in a reasonable amount of time. I could be
absolutely.
The highway could turn into a parking lot, and I could sit there for an hour.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you think about it, a lot of transportation professionals have definitely come to understand that it's impossible at this moment in time for us to build our way out of congestion. The more highways we build, the more roads we build, the more we try and move people, the roads still remain parking lots after some time because of the massive growth and effects of induced demand on transportation. So the idea here is that you're absolutely right. Highways are going to be congested for the near and long-term future as far as we're concerned. So it's time to start looking at more innovative ways to move people. So let's assume possibly that Hyperloop is running along something similar to that 35 corridor, but even just to begin with, if it was freight only, you'd still be opening so much capacity on the highway just by having a dedicated freight mover along the highway in a Hyperloop that then it would alleviate congestion just by removing the freight, opening up more room for passengers. And then, like you said, if and when it does become both a passenger freight system, you can have the option of driving on the highway or using Hyperloop. You're increasing capacity, but we're reducing our reliance on highways, which is a very important key, since we know that the ability for us to continually build highways to address congestion long term is very limited.
This is Texas Matters. I'm David Martin Davies. I'm speaking with Stephen Duong, who is leading a project to make Hyperloop a reality in Texas.
One thing that would cobble the effectiveness, if you're able to build a Hyperloop and it does all the things that you're telling me, you know, I can fly to Dallas and get there in an hour, but getting to the airport, getting on the plane, getting off the plane, getting out of that airport, that's the drag on that trip. So designing the, I don't know what you're going to call them, pod ports or hyper stations, I don't know, but designing those things in a way that you can, and then safety, you're going to have the TSA there as well, I'm sure. So is that going to be fly any ointment?
No, not necessarily. I think a lot of the way that these different Hyperloop companies are approaching it, and obviously this is still up in the air because it's for federal and state regulators to ultimately decide, but if you ever ridden on a high-speed train or commuter rail in another country or even someplace in the U.S., you'll realize that there is security, but it's significantly less than what TSA requires. And so the idea here is that as easy as it is to hop onto an Amtrak or a high-speed rail train in France or something similar is the level of security effort that you would have to go for something like the Hyperloop, which is much less of a burden than what you would ordinarily go through on an airline. The also idea there, which I think you kind of touched upon perfectly, is that the distance for a trip that is perfect for the Hyperloop is kind of, there's a sweet spot for it. It's kind of the distance where flying doesn't make sense, which if you're thinking about flying from San Antonio to Dallas, oftentimes it doesn't make sense because, like you said, you're going through TSA longer than you are actually in the air. But it's also too long distance, just like you said, where it's convenient and comfortable to drive because of traffic, because of the length of the drive. People don't necessarily want to do that drive. So there's a sweet spot. And the distance between the Texas metro cities are ideal for something like the Hyperloop because they fit right in that sweet spot where it's not necessarily comfortable to fly, it's not necessarily comfortable to drive.
But now we're seeing the dawn of self-driving cars hitting consumers, and they're going to be perfect for long-distance driving like this. You can just point them in the direction of the city you want to go to, and it'll take you there. Hey, well, I'll just do that. I'll sleep the entire way while I'm waiting to get to Dallas.
Sure. Yeah. So actually, the way the various Hyperloop companies are thinking, they are very much imagining Hyperloop technology as sort of a next-generation high-speed rail in the era of autonomous vehicles. So the one issue with your scenario there is that currently, and I think the understanding for most people, is that autonomous vehicles, by the time they're ready to be level 5 and fully autonomous, that someone could do that, they'll be electric. And at the moment, battery technology and charging technology doesn't allow someone to do that trip as seamlessly as using a internal combustion engine with gasoline. So by the time you arrive to your destination, you're going to have to top off the battery in your vehicle, which is not nearly as instantaneous as filling up your gas with car. Most battery, I think the longest range distance of an EV right now is about 330 miles or so. And so you would eat up that entire battery just doing one of these drives. So think of loading your car up into a Hyperloop, shipping it to the next city, you know, at extremely high speeds, and arriving at your city with your car seamlessly, and the car is already fully charged to be able to move around the city.
But the main advantage for the Hyperloop is actually going to be the amount of time that it would take to travel. Is that what you see that as? And so it's still, even if I'm in an autonomous vehicle, it's going to take me multiple hours to get from Laredo to Dallas, and almost a full day. And then, but if I'm in a Hyperloop, that's still a trip that can be done under an hour.
Absolutely, yes. And that change in speed really changes the dynamics of how we do business and develop our cities, honestly, right? Most American cities, especially the ones that are growing quick right now, are kind of developed in what we call a kind of a post-war model after World War II, which largely revolves around the time and distance and scale of the personal automobile. So if Hyperloop was to be in play, the idea that the size of your cities, the way we develop, the way we locate businesses and residences and spread them across the city radically changes because of the speed of the Hyperloop. So absolutely, the speed is the most benefit. But the interesting thing about the speed is that it affects so many other aspects of urban systems that you really have to rethink how cities are actually laid out spatially and work together. And I mentioned earlier at the beginning of the call that you need to start treating the various cities as one city, as a mega region, which also requires you to ask much different questions from an urban planning perspective. So if you had the availability or the possibility to live in San Antonio but work in Dallas and have a faster commute than maybe on a really bad traffic day from, you know, a far-out suburb of San Antonio to downtown San Antonio, you know, that really changes the equation of where your options are, where you want to work and where you want to live. So those all factor into, those are all kind of a function of the speed and availability of Hyperloop.
But then there's cost. I mean, how much would a ticket cost?
Yeah, and with the ticket costs and even the infrastructure costs, there's no way really to have a number right now because the technology is too early in its infancy. Additionally, the cost of building the system is far too dependent on actually where you build it. So most long linear infrastructure projects like this, their costs are so heavily tied to the actual exact alignment of where you build it, which for Hyperloop is nowhere near to being decided yet. So both the cost of the system and the cost of the ticket is far too early to know what that number is. However, Hyperloop One, they are hoping and aiming for a ticket cost that is very comparable to something like a Greyhound ticket. The idea is that they can achieve ticket prices like that based on the volume and frequency of the trips they're providing. And so that's ultimately their goal. That's not to say that that's going to be the cost of the ticket, you know, for the very first system, which most likely is going to be much higher because at that point it'll be kind of a limited luxury system. But the idea is to eventually drive down that cost to something very affordable. But it's far too early to know and to place a number on what a ticket cost may be or the actual cost per mile of the infrastructure itself.
Most people don't know the cost structure for a Greyhound ticket. Usually, I guess, a ticket from San Antonio to Dallas would be under $100.
Right, exactly. Right around 100, maybe a little bit less. And so in an ideal world, if Hyperloop's able to accomplish what they're hoping to do, I think you can maybe expect to see ticket prices in a similar range in the very long-term future.
Okay, so let's talk about the challenges. I mean, this is a big lift trying to get something like this into reality. Right now, you're getting some discussion. We're talking about this as if this were a certainty, but there are a lot of hurdles to clear. What's the number one?
Oh, absolutely, the policy side. So the technology side, I think a lot of people think that they'll be, the various Hyperloop companies working on, including Virgin Hyperloop One, will be able to figure out the technology over time. The policy and regulatory framework that allows something like this to occur in the U.S. is very difficult. I think almost unanimously people will point to it as the number one obstacle to have to navigate. There are places elsewhere in the world that have much looser regulatory frameworks, namely, Southeast Asia and the Middle East, that have also expressed very strong interest in Hyperloop. The national governments, I think, of both India and several countries in the Middle East were on the test site in Nevada for Virgin Hyperloop 1 very recently. They're very interested in deploying technology. Dubai in particular has their Vision 30 of Dubai program, which is to move the country towards kind of a futuristic smart city concept by then. And they're very much thinking Hyperloop will be a cornerstone of that concept. So in places of the world where you see that looser regulatory framework, I think there's a chance you could see Hyperloop occur there first, prove itself, and then come over to the United States over the long run, just because the environmental regulatory framework of deploying a brand new technology like this in the States is very difficult. Now, the other thing I'll say, though, is that there's reason for optimism, because whenever there's a technology with such a high upside, you will often see kind of the policy obstacles kind of part to the side, if you will, just to allow it to make it happen. Assuming, something like autonomous vehicles or Hyperloop can reduce traffic fatalities, which I think annually in the U.S. right now are floating around 44,000 or so. Let's just say theoretically you cut that down by 50% just from removing the automobile deaths on highways. That alone by itself, the number of lives that could be saved and the efficiencies on traffic and congestion by itself is reason to think that policy will and can move much quicker than we're used to. But that doesn't change the fact that it probably remains the most difficult obstacle to navigate.
How clean is Hyperloop? Will this take vehicles off the road and help us reduce our overall national carbon footprint?
Yeah, it's intended to be very clean. One of the major benefits, it is an all-electric system. It's using a linear induction motor, which is completely electrically powered. And the idea is, if it's electric power, there are options and ideas out there to power it completely by solar and wind, running off to the side or feeding into the grid. It's not dependent on fossil fuels and gasoline, which means that it has clean emissions, it has the potential for using completely renewable energy sources to power it. So I don't know if it'll necessarily reduce, let's say, the amount of cars on the road. That's a pretty difficult thing to forecast at this time, considering all the changes that are happening, not just with Hyperloop, but in the autonomous vehicle space. But I can say that the more trips you have through Hyperloop is definitely and most certainly going to be a benefit on the environment, as opposed to our current dependency on internal combustion engines.
Please keep your optimism in check and tell me, when do you think we will see the first Hyperloop ride in Texas?
Oh, in Texas. That's very difficult for me to pin down. I'd like to say that I think you could see the first Hyperloop ride occur in the late 2020s. I don't know if that's necessarily going to be in the U.S. or international. I tend to think personally that it may be international. But optimistically, or maybe if I'm checking my optimism, I think 2030s is actually very doable. And some people might say that's overly optimistic, but I'm kind of looking at the overall trends of technology adoption and investment into infrastructure, is particularly innovative infrastructure in the U.S. And so I think saying the 2030s is not unreasonable at all.
Stephen Duong is the Hyperloop Texas project leader for AECOM, a Fortune 500 engineering and construction firm. This week, the Dallas-Fort Worth Regional Transportation Council announced plans to study bringing Hyperloop to the DFW area. That's a major step forward in taking this experimental high-speed transportation technology and making it part of the infrastructure of Texas. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's also where you can listen to past Texas Matters programs, and you can find us wherever you get those podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.